Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sammy Mack.
I'm Gina Jordan. We're sitting in for Tom Hudson. He's out this week.
477. That's how many Florida children died in the past decade in homes that the Department of Children and Families had been warned were unsafe. They tumbled into canals and drowned, baked in furnace-like cars, were soaked in corrosive chemicals, incinerated, beaten mercilessly, and bounced off walls and concrete pavement. One was jammed into a cooler posthumously, others were wrapped like a mummy to silence their cries, flattened by a truck, overdosed, and starved. That is from the first installment of the Innocence Lost series. With us in the studio right now are Audra Birch and Carol Marvin Miller, who worked on the investigation for 3 years with the Miami Herald. Joining us this hour from Tallahassee is Margie Menzel of the News Service of Florida, who has also been following DCF. So, Carol, Audra, 477 dead children. How did this happen?
Well, beginning about a decade ago, the state of Florida mounted an ambitious and rigorous family preservation program. Now, there's nothing wrong with preserving families. It's a good thing. Foster care is no way to raise children. And adolescents who grow up in foster care will tell you that, for the most part, they would have liked to have been able to grow up with their families. The problem with Florida's family preservation effort was that it was launched at exactly the same time that state revenues were declining. We had the Great Recession, and it's impossible to do a safe family preservation effort when services for at-risk families also are declining. The money that would have gone for supervision, oversight, and services for these troubled families just wasn't there. Drug treatment for addicted parents, anger management, or domestic violence counseling for men who are violent. There simply wasn't enough money for those services, and so as a practical matter, what we've been doing for the last several years is leaving children in oftentimes dangerous homes with no safety net.
And when we talk about these children who are in these homes where families were being preserved, or there weren't the resources to send these parents to the support services that they needed. I mean, what do we know about the children who ended up being the victims of this situation?
Some of these kids or their families were on the DCF radar for years and years and years. We had cases in which DCF had been warned 5 times, 8 times, 10 times, 20 times, in a couple of cases close to 30 times, that members of a family were at risk or downright in danger. We had a case, a little boy by the name of Caleb Kronk. His mother had been the subject of well over 25 reports to the hotline involving a variety of allegations, physical abuse, drug addiction that rendered the family unfit. And over time, what DCF was doing with those families is simply kicking the can down the road to the next investigation. But when the next call to the hotline came, they would simply kick it down the road again. And so you had these families in which the dynamic was getting worse and worse and worse, and the children were left there with no real protection.
Every single one of these cases are documented in a website that you have, where you have profiled what happened in each of these 477 cases, and every single one of them is horrifying. What are some of the common threads that you found when you were going through these cases?
I think that if you look at the database, which features 477 of the children, you will find that in many of the cases, the home was already dysfunctional, and that there were either not enough services put in the home that could mitigate the risk, or no services had been put in at all. The other thing that you find is that the vast majority of the children are babies. They were something like 80% were under 5. And what we know about that age range is that they simply don't have the capacity to ask for help. So it's incumbent upon the protective agency to make sure that the home is safe.
Now, from what I understand from reading the series, the family preservation policy was based on some research that showed that sometimes it's better for kids to stay in situations that are imperfect than necessarily to be removed from the house. That can be even more traumatic. But that's problematic. What did you find?
The research upon which DCF based this policy largely, if not entirely, involved adolescents, not babies, infants, and toddlers. And it's true, if you talk to a 15-year-old who's been in foster care for some period of time, they're likely to tell you that they had wished they'd been left with their parents. Foster care is no fun if you're a teenager. You have state agents deciding where you can go at night, what friends you can visit, what you can have, what you can do. And there's no question that minimizing the effects of foster care is a laudable goal. However, the research that says that children fare better when they don't enter the foster care system simply didn't relate to infants and toddlers who have, as Audra just said, no protective capacities. And these were children who were at risk of dying in the most mundane ways. They would be smothered to death in bed because their parents took too much OxyContin and couldn't wake up and realize they were on top of the infant. They would toddle into canals because their parents were in bed at 2 o'clock in the afternoon sleeping off their high. And for small children who can't speak up, who can't protect themselves, a really unforgiving family preservation problem is going to be dangerous.
One of the cases that you documented, Audra, was the Gordon twins. Can you tell us about the Gordon twins?
Yes. In 2011, Rachel Fryer suffocated her son, her twin son, in a co-sleeping accident in which she was asleep on the sofa. And during the investigation, she tested positive for cocaine. So the surviving children were removed and put into the foster care system. And she embarked upon a reunification goal. And roughly 2 years later, after she met some of the criteria, she was the children were returned to the home, including Tavante's twin sister, Tarigi. And they were returned in November. And 3 months later, she was killed. She was beaten. And the mother, Ms. Fryer, says that she didn't do it. In fact, that she found her unresponsive. We're not sure exactly what happened, but what we know now is that she is actually in jail and she has been charged with her murder.
So with us on the line right now, we have a representative from DCF, Gilda Faridez. She's the DCF Managing Director for the Southern Region. Gilda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Gilda, what's your reaction to this series in the Herald and when you hear these stories?
Well, whenever there are tragedies like this, we look very closely at everything that happened, and we just reemphasize our efforts to do better and to learn as much as we can from these terrible tragedies that happened and improve our systems moving forward. And that's what we've been doing for the past several months now.
Yeah, and I know that one of the things that happened right as this series was coming out was that DCF put out a couple of press releases that made it seem like they had partnered with the Herald, but the Herald had to sue several times to get access to these public records. What is the thinking behind that in the press office at DCF?
Well, I can't speak for the press office for DCF. That's probably not press office in Tallahassee. I'm here in Miami. But I know that the department is committed to transparency as much as we can. And when there are issues of confidentiality in the statute or whatever that prevent us from putting out information, we, you know, do what we can to put that information out because we think, you know, transparency benefits everyone.
From where you're sitting, what do you think you need to make this system work better?
Well, we're doing many things since the Herald series came out, and prior to that, when we were already starting to analyze these cases, we had partnered with KC Family Programs, which, as you know, is a nationally recognized foundation that focuses on improving child welfare systems. So we asked them to come in and partner with us and review these cases and help us in our in our quest to improve our system. So Casey did make a number of recommendations, which we're implementing, and provided us with an analysis of their findings of the cases that they reviewed.
Gilda, you're pretty much on the hot seat, and we appreciate you talking with us. You know, we're just wondering, you guys are doing the best you can trying to get the word out that you're working on these changes, but at the same time, we had Senator Eleanor Sobel, who is chair of a powerful committee in the Senate, talk about how she feels like DCF is being defensive and that it's an uphill battle. What could you say to that?
Well, I didn't hear the senator's comments on that, but what I can tell you is that we're basically trying to make changes as the system continues to move. We continue to get calls every day. One of the good things that we think that comes out of a series like this is that the public is more aware of signs of abuse and so forth, and our reporting goes up. So in the last couple of weeks, we have had an uptick in the number of referrals that we're receiving. That's good, I think, that there's more awareness out there and we're getting more referrals, but at the same time, that's more work for the workforce, which is something that we struggle with, and to implement the changes and at the same time keep up with the number of cases that are coming in to be investigated.
You said there's a lot of struggles. Is there any one thing in particular that you feel like is standing in the way of being able to really implement strong reforms?
Well, I think the big thing that we is going to offer us relief and is going to offer us the ability to spend more time on each case and really analyze each case is the governor's recommendation for increased funding so that we can hire more protective investigators, so that we can get those caseload ratios down to a manageable level, and investigators are actually able to spend the time that they need to spend with each family. So we're grateful that the governor has proposed close to $32 million in increases to hire additional investigators, plus an additional $8 million for the sheriffs who do investigations around the state.
And in a few minutes, we're actually going to talk about some of what's happening with the legislative response. But thank you very much for joining us. And I just wanted to, before we get into that, talk, Carol and Audra, about some of the real human impact of what happens with these cases, these children. The Herald spoke to two grandmothers who tried to protect their grandchildren, and we have some sound from that. This is Stacy Malini, grandmother of 5-year-old Ashton Lynette Arnold, and Loretta Young, grandmother of 1-year-old Tori Diamond.
Because I didn't have legal custody of her, I only had guardianship, there was nothing that could be done.
They would be high, and I would run in and pick Tori up off the floor and come out, call Children's Family Services, call Davie Police Department, this is what's going on. Help me protect my grandchild.
And the nurse came and got us, and she walked us into the room, and Ashton was gone. And all I could say was no. No, 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 no.
His skull was crushed. He had blood stains. He had been brutally beat.
Again, that was Stacy Molinelli, grandmother of 5-year-old Ashton Lynette Arnold, and Loretta Young, grandmother of 1-year-old Tori Diamond. To read their stories and those of the other 475 children who died under DCF's care in the past 10 years, you can find a link on our website at WLRN.org. Of course, the Miami Herald has a really fantastic multimedia project where you can see Audra and Carol's work. We want to hear from you. Have you had experiences with DCF? Have you volunteered as a guardian ad litem or a foster parent? Give us a call. It's 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN or go to WLRN.org where we have a live blog going. You can participate in the conversation. Still to come, Tallahassee lawmakers respond to the 477 deaths. Stay with us on the Florida Roundup on WLRN.
I'm Gina Jordan.
And I'm Sammy Mack.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're joined by Carol Marbin Miller with the Miami Herald, Audra Birch with the Miami Herald, and Margie Menzel with News Service of Florida. We're talking about the deaths of 477 children under the state's watch. Your questions are welcome. Email us with your first name and your location to the Florida Roundup at WLRNnews.org. You can also call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. And you can tweet us at WLRN. We have an online discussion going at WLRN.org. Margie, let's talk about policy. There were already some proposals to make reforms at DCF before the Innocence Lost series. Now even more changes are in the works. So fill us in on some of the legislation that's been filed.
Okay. It's important to put this in perspective by saying that a lot of this legislation got underway last fall as a result of media reports of children's deaths that happened in the spring and summer, the deaths of children that were already known to the Department of Children and Families. And there was a great deal of concern about this. It was already one of the top legislative priorities in the work plan by the presiding officers of the two chambers. The committee started meeting last fall, Gail Harrell's committee in September, taking testimony from a very wide range of people with some knowledge of the child welfare system. And a lot of it was contradictory. And the legislation that has resulted is extremely complex. What we have in our hands at this point is the House bill. And Representative Harrell has been amazing in driving the House Healthy Families Subcommittee on this and several other sweeping pieces of legislation. And it's got a bunch of provisions that both chambers are in agreement on, or close to agreement. And then there's some stuff that's being worked on as we speak. I spoke with Senator Sobel. I went by Senator Dietert's office yesterday to kind of get the latest. They're still working on this. Above all, they don't know in the Senate how much money they're going to be asking for the services, which are considered critical.
Money always a big issue. We have a caller. Let's hear from Nan in Orlando. Hi, Nan. Nan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for speaking to me.
Certainly. What's your question?
I didn't see the address in the excellent series, which I very much appreciated the work of, but a man named Alan Abramowitz, an insider with DCF for many decades now, eliminated appeals of non-criminal abuse labels 20 years ago. These are mandated by the federal government, HHS, and Florida is one of just a handful of states to cut them out. Parents who did appeal abuse labels, many of which were malicious, pranksters, the Florida Teachers Association got involved at one point and had to sue because so many kids called in fake reports on teachers. Parents were successful more than half the time in appealing non-criminal abuse designations. It helped reinforce that these are actual abuse cases and not pranks or divorce issues or other nonsense calls. When Alan Abramowitz, two other people, there's a Florida Senate report about this, eliminated this, those bureaucrats were left to their own devices. And in non-criminal cases that do not go before judges, which is increasingly common, the bureaucrat's word is a fiat. This is incredibly unfair. It's a violation of federal law, and it helps support the establishment of a national child abuse registry. Because to do that, you have to show that you've used due process in your state, and Florida can't. I'd like to know if there are any questions.
So I guess the question is, you know, why did Florida eliminate these child abuse appeals? Carol, Audra, can you weigh in on that?
Florida, and this actually goes back to the mid-1990s, redesigned what was called the Abuse Registry. And I think this occurred around 1996. The sponsor of the legislation was Lois Frankel, who later became mayor of West Palm Beach. What they did was they eliminated, as you said, the right of parents to appeal a finding that's reflected in the Abuse Registry. And in exchange for that, the abuse registry was essentially shut down as a tool. And so if you run, for instance, an assisted living facility, and you want to know whether someone who wants to get a job working for you as a caregiver has an abuse history, you can't. And a few years ago when the Herald published a series about ALFs, we found, among other things, that caregivers with a history of abuse or neglect were being hired because the facilities had no ability whatsoever to do a background check with DCF. Essentially, what that legislation was about, like everything in Florida, was saving money because lawyers were being paid a fortune to defend the state of Florida when parents and others appealed a finding in the abuse registry.
Very good. Let's talk with Representative Gail Harrell. She is joining us on the phone. She is a Republican from Port St. Lucie and chair of the Healthy Families Subcommittee in the Florida House. Representative, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's delightful to be here.
Well, let's talk about some legislation. We already had some legislation proposed to fix some of the problems at DCF that was moving through committees, and now we're adding some changes since this Innocence Lost series came out. What can you tell us about what is being considered now?
Well, we have been looking at the entire child welfare system the entire year, actually since September in our Healthy Families Committee. It's been a major focus of the committee over the entire year. The series has certainly been very, very informative and just heartbreaking, unbelievably heartbreaking. And as I said in the committee the other day, I want to commend the Miami Herald for what they have done in really focusing the spotlight on child abuse. It's something I've been involved with since over 30 years ago as a founding board member of Hibiscus Children's Center. So I appreciate all the hard work of the Miami Herald in doing that. What we really are doing in this bill, and it's a very comprehensive bill. Excuse me, I have got a terrible cold. It is really looking at five very specific areas. We have, in looking at our system as it exists now, we really want to update and upgrade our workforce. I think that is a key component, so that our child protective investigators, excuse me, and our case managers have the skill set that's necessary to really identify what the risk factors are. And we are very much on a march to upgrade and update those skill sets. We want to make sure they have the investigation skills for the CPIs. We want to make sure that they, excuse me, that they have the knowledge base and those critical thinking skills. So it's going to take some time, and we're going to put some money into it in the way of tuition reimbursement and also loan forgiveness. So it's not going to be inexpensive, but I think it's a key component of what we're doing. Secondly,
Sorry,
do you have a question on that section first?
Well, I was just wondering specifically about money for services.
Oh, we're getting there. We're definitely getting there. We're really looking at transparency and wanting to make sure we know we have accurate data on our website about child deaths. One of the things the Miami Herald focused on was the lack of appropriate reporting. We're going to change that. There's no doubt about it. We're going to know, and we're going to put them on a website. No names of families or anything of that sort, but we're going to know where these deaths are occurring. We also are very data-driven and going to make sure that we do the in-depth analysis of each death. And part of that will be part of the accountability we're going to be putting in place.
Representative Harrell, this is Carol. A quick question for you.
Yes.
One of the philosophical changes that we recommended, and we did so based upon dozens of interviews with child welfare experts, was that Florida specifically and explicitly and emphatically pass a law that grants rights to children. The right to survive, the right to be well, the right not to be a parent's punching bag. And I'm wondering why your bill does not address that. It has been our observation, and certainly that of the experts with whom we consulted, that the reform that you are mounting can only go so far so long as children are still regarded implicitly as the property of their parents.
We are not looking at that specific issue.
Why?
The bill is focused really on addressing the system. We want to make the systemic changes. Children's rights are very evident as this bill goes into action. You will see that we are focusing on children, and we're doing that very specifically in looking at what at the development of the safety plans and the the definitions of impending danger and imminent danger, and we're making sure that mental health is one of those required services. We're putting a stress on making sure children come first.
Representative,
medically complex children, all of that.
If your emphasis is that children come first, what is the harm, what is the downside to saying explicitly in statute that children have rights? Why not? What's the downside?
That is not the purpose of this bill. The purpose of this bill is to look at the system. That would have to be a separate bill. If you're really going to talk about defining children's rights, that is really the subject of a separate bill.
Why? I don't understand.
Legislatively, that is how the process works. You have things called germanity that are very clear. And if you're talking about rights versus a system and services, you need to have that in a separate bill.
And for a layperson, germanity, what is that?
Germanity is what is the purpose of the bill. And we have very specific rules in the House that say a bill has a defined purpose, and you have to stay within that purpose. And you can have a point of order called very easily on if you deviate too widely from the purpose of the bill. The purpose of this bill, truly, is to look at the system, and that is what we're doing.
Do you think somebody in the House would call this bill out and end it if that was in there? Do you think there would be opposition to that?
You know, I don't know that. I think you have to... Parents have rights and responsibilities. And if you get into defining rights and responsibilities of parents and rights of children, that takes the bill in a totally different focus. And if someone wanted to file a bill to do that, that's a separate subject. This bill is focused strictly on making the system better, changing the system to deal with those children and focus on the needs of those children.
With regard to those children, Representative, the bill that the governor is proposing would add several hundred additional child protective investigators. My question is this: if you do not have an adequate drug treatment program, we quoted two judges as saying that the drug treatment program in Florida was putrid. One of the judges down here called it dangerous. If you are not head-on addressing the safety plans, if you are doing nothing with regard to the independence of lawyers, if you are doing none of that, and if you're adding $5 million, which is $95 million less than 2 years ago, what are you doing? You've got 400 investigators, but they can't actually help children because there are no services in place to do that. We have waiting lists for drug treatment. We have waiting lists for child care. We have waiting lists for domestic violence and anger management classes. How do you propose to improve the lives of these children when we have seen a net $95 million loss within the last 2 years?
This bill, and we're not through appropriations yet, so I can't speak to the total package of dollars yet. We're still very much working on that. But we have commitments from Representative Hudson and the Appropriations Committee that we're putting a large amount of money into this, into services. And my argument against what the governor has said in putting 400 CPIs out there is that you don't have the ability to handle the cases, we are going to put $10 million directly into services.
And Representative Harrell, we're actually hearing from someone right now who called into our show. This is Ray in Bradenton. Ray, I understand your concern that your granddaughter is in danger right now.
Yes.
What is the situation?
Well, let me just comment on this last caller saying that children has rights. I was specifically told by the judge in this case, and by the way, I'm from Bradenton, but my case was in Miami, that I was specifically told that children do not have rights. He said that right in the courtroom. And what happened was me and my wife have brought up my granddaughter since birth. She was 7 and a half. They terminated my daughter's rights in Miami. The biological father was in prison, a two-time convicted felon, home invasion, shot somebody for drugs. Never had anything to do with my granddaughter. My wife and I are the only two people she ever knew or lived with. I never asked the state for any money. We brought her up. The biological father got out of prison. His mother had five kids by five different guys, welfare system, whatever. They court-ordered him to pay child support. By the way, in court, when he was in prison, he said, "I don't want her. They can have her. I can't give her what they give her." Well, when he got out and was ordered to pay child support, it was a different story. Now he can collect a welfare check. He went back to the court and told them he wanted custody. All the three previous judges and the two previous first two state attorneys, you know, they wanted us to adopt, and we were agreed. They gave a new state attorney and a new judge. By the way, the new judge is one of he's a judge that two of his kids were the last 20 that got killed, and he was the one that handled my granddaughter's case. And I just kept on hearing him in court say we could never talk in court in the courtroom because we were nobody. All we were was a caregiver.
Ray, you know? I want to bring in Carol Marvin Miller here. Carol, how common is that? Is this story? How often did you hear this in the series?
Constantly. And with all due respect to the representative, this is the exact scenario that explains why children must have rights. Tarigi Gordon is another example of that. Tarigi had essentially been raised in foster care. She had been removed from her mother when she was a newborn, and she was raised in foster care. And then it was someone's bright idea that she needed to be reunified with her mother. The caseworkers who were involved with that family said emphatically that that was a bad idea. But in Florida, Rachel Gordon had a right to a child who didn't know her, and no amount of family preservation will justify what was done to that child because she didn't know her mother, she had no bond with her mother, and yet she was sent to live back with a mother who, police say, later killed her. And this is why I would argue, with all due respect, Representative Harrell, that the rights of children is fundamental to any discussion of child welfare, because if state law said clearly that Tarigi Gordon had a right to be raised where she would be healthy and well and she would survive, then she would never have been sent to live with a mother that she didn't know.
I have one more question for Representative Harrell. Representative, you were in the House about 10 years ago when there was a lot of there was a lot of funding that was cut to DCF, and the series mentions that there's a direct correlation between these funding cuts and these children dying. Could you give us an idea of what was going on back at that time when the decision was made to cut so much funding from DCF?
I believe, now I was not there in 2009, 2010. I was only there through 2008 and then was reelected in 2010. So there's a gap there where significant funding was cut. So I can't speak to that time frame. What I can do is speak to the unfortunate cuts that we were compelled to make because of the terrific downturn in the economy. And we really had to look very carefully across the board at everything. And we really asked everyone to tighten their belts and, you know, across the spectrum. we had to deal with the increases in the numbers of people in Medicaid, and that was a significant factor in dealing with the budget, and you have to make very serious cuts. I am very pleased that we are going to be putting a significant amount of money into the system now, and I will be an advocate as we move forward to continue to do that, to improve the system, to make it more accountable and more child-focused, so that we do, and as we move forward, this is the first step, and I think we're going to change the system to make it that very child-focused and also very accountable, so that we're going to be really looking at all the programs across what's effective, what's not effective, in specifically responding to child deaths. We're going to put in place some rapid response teams so that we get really look at root causes. And when we've already started to do some analysis, and we had SAS do a look across all the child deaths and do an analysis of them so that we can really improve our system. And certainly the one, several things pop out, and the Miami Herald pointed it out very, very vividly in many of the case studies, is the increased risk where young children are at.
Representative, this is Audra Birch. I had a very quick question for you. When you talk about accountability, can you talk very specifically? You know, we spent years and years trying to get information, some of which was actually public. So if you could help me understand how we're going to make the system much more accountable to the voters.
Well, I think the website is going to be key. And child deaths are going to be reported on that website. The county it took place in, the CBC, if they were in the care of a CBC, you know, they will be reported. We're also going to evaluate the CBCs on the websites. We're going to put their budgets there. We're going to make sure that...
And which website is this for somebody who isn't familiar with the bill?
The DCF website will have this information on it.
Representative Harrell, with regard to posting child deaths online, one of the things that we told in our story last Sunday was that the number of deaths attributed to neglect, particularly drowning deaths and in-bed smotherings, especially involving parents who are impaired by drugs and alcohol, those things appear to decline, but really haven't, because DCF was allowed to redefine neglect in such a way that if you did not deliberately intend to allow your child to drown, then it just didn't count. Do you have any desire to make these numbers more reflective of what is going on in real life?
One of the things in what I'm calling right now my parking lot, and things that we have not yet gotten to, we've kept this bill in the Healthy Families Committee for 3 weeks. It's actually been there since September, but we really workshopped it for 3 weeks before we passed it out. And I have several issues in my parking lot that we're going to address as we move forward. They've kind of parked on the side so we could focus on other things. The interplay and interaction and how we're going to structure this rapid response team, their responsibilities versus the overall death review team and their responsibilities, because I don't want duplication. If we're looking at root causes within a specific death, that's the job of the rapid response team. Our child death review team will be, we're going to look at that more broadly.
We thank you so much for joining us. We're running out of time, but
I'm sorry.
You have a tough job ahead. But yes. Thank you so much for speaking with us. We appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for including me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Still to come, it's not all about the lawmakers. What can regular people do right now to make a difference? Stay with us on the Florida Roundup on WLRN.
I'm Sammy Mack.
And I'm Gina Jordan.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. All this hour, we're talking about the 477 children who have died under the watch of Florida's Department of Children and Families in the past decade. We just heard about proposed bills at the state level, but we are talking now with Carol Marvin Miller of the Miami Herald, Audra Birch of the Miami Herald, and Margie Menzel in Tallahassee, and joining us is Fran Allegra as well.
Good afternoon.
So we've heard what you can do on a state level. What can communities, civilian citizens do? Carol?
Well, I think there are a variety of programs and efforts underway to help troubled children and to help parents that are struggling. One of the things that a layperson can do is to volunteer for the Guardian Ad Litem program, which supplies advocates for children in the court system, children who have faced abuse or neglect. If you care about small babies who are at risk of neglect, one of the things I've seen people do that's creative and feels good and will make you feel good about yourself, go to a trauma center, go to a hospital with a neonatal unit, and hold babies that were born drug addicted, whose parents don't show up to care for them. My own daughter spent a couple of months in a hospital, and I saw old women show up, and they would hold babies, and they would knit caps. And it's tremendous for those infants who otherwise would have very little chance of learning how to bond. Write letters to your lawmaker if you feel strongly about what's going on in Florida. If you are a grandparent or an aunt or uncle and you care deeply about a little one who you think is in danger, there is something called a private dependency petition. And we are suggesting that people avail themselves of that opportunity. What that means is if you were Stacy Molinelli and you were trying to get help for your grandchild and DCF would not allow you to do that, you may go to court in Florida and you may file a petition that asks a judge to declare that child dependent and allows you to protect that child from his or her mother and father. It's a very well-kept secret, but you have that right in Florida.
The other thing that you can do is if you are aware of an abusive situation, please, please use their hotline. And when they are investigating these cases, you need to be honest about what you've witnessed. We have case after case where after the child is dead, we have neighbors and family members come forward and say they saw it. Well, it's too late at that point. So you need to step up and you need to, you know, be willing to make the phone call.
And Fran Allegra, you are CEO of Our Kids. What do you see as a need that...
I just want to say thanks for to WLRN for the Florida Roundup and I want to say thanks again to Audra, Carol, and the Miami Herald for spending the kind of resources on a story this important. It's unprecedented. And I do thank you for using this platform for something so important, because after a huge story like that series comes out, we need to continue to have public dialogue about what to do, because it's almost overwhelming for readers. So we need to continue to understand it. Carol's absolutely right when she talks about Florida Statutes Chapter 39 allows for any person with knowledge to file a petition. Those petitions are rarely sought, and Carol's right. It is an avenue if you're a family member that's exhausted every other avenue. The Guardian Ad Litem program is an excellent place to roll up your sleeves and get involved in the lives of children that are in the dependency system. If you don't have that kind of time and you'd like to still contribute, in Miami we have something called Foster Care Review, where average citizens sit as judges. They've been trained by Foster Care Review and they sit as judges. But I'm here to tell you about becoming a foster parent, because right now Our Kids is in the midst of a huge campaign. There is important awareness stories like Carol and Audra's make, for whatever reason, and we can talk about that, make the numbers of kids in foster care climb in reaction to stories, or so it feels like that. So we are right now at a point, and I know in Broward it's the same case, we need more and more foster homes. We need people that and I'm not talking about if you're not able to make a full commitment. There's something called respite care, where you can be licensed and approved to take kids on an emergency basis for a short term. And then, of course, there's something longer term. To be a foster parent is incredibly difficult, but we believe that we need more, and we believe there's a lot more individuals in Miami that could step up and serve that purpose, and also in the Florida Keys as well.
And we have a caller right now, Justine from Miami. Justine, you are a former foster child?
Yes, I was.
And what was that experience like for you?
That experience was very harrowing for me.
What made it so?
Because I have been denied food while in foster care, and when I was hungry and I wanted to eat, I was denied. And then several years later, when I was in foster care again, which was the second time.
What years were you in foster care?
Oh, gosh. This was back in the mid to late 70s.
And I want to ask, Fran, how has the screening of potential foster care parents changed?
You know, I'm so sorry for Justine and having that terrible experience. I can't imagine enduring something so terrible. I think the strength of community-based care, which was passed in this state more than a decade ago, was about opening up and being more transparent, pull back the curtain about how the child welfare system works. Guess what? The child welfare system is ours. Everyone in this community can make it as good as it is. If it's not good enough, then you need to get involved. And because of community-based care, the law allows communities to take responsibility and ownership of how they want their child welfare system to look. And the screening of foster parents has changed dramatically. You're always going to have people in it for the wrong reasons, unfortunately. And then you're going to have incredible stories of incredible people. I spend a lot of time with foster parents, and I am floored by the amazing group of people that are Miami's foster parents. It's an incredibly great group of selfless individuals who are in it for the right reasons.
Well, the conversation is coming to a close here today on the Florida Roundup, but I just wanted to tell everyone that the Miami Herald is hosting a town hall to explore the ways to fix the state's child welfare system. That event is going to take place at 6 p.m. on April 17th at the Miami Herald headquarters in Doral. You can RSVP by emailing eventinfo@miamiherald.com. Again, that's eventinfo@miamiherald.com. And I want to thank again Carol Marvin Miller from the Miami Herald and Audra Birch from the Miami Herald, who have worked on this investigative series. Also, we had on the line today Margie Menzel in Tallahassee with the News Service of Florida. And, of course, Gina Jordan has been sitting in with me for Tom Hudson this week. That is going to do it for the Florida Roundup for Friday, March 28th, 2014. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., or we'll post it on our website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our online chat was curated by our digital editor, Maria Muriel. And our executive producer is Peter J. Mertz. Technical supervision from Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Sammy Mack, along with Gina Jordan. Thanks for listening, and thank you everyone for joining us on today's show.